My name is Jeff. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic and addict. My sobriety date is April 20th in the year of the Lord, 2009. Thank you, Janice, for always being here in the rooms, the online rooms, the AA Unity room and the Southern Comfort room, and always being of service. And thank you for allowing me to share today. Welcome, family. I hope to share my experiences, strengths, and hopes as I progress through sharing my first online meeting. I've chaired meetings before in person, and it's been a long time. I haven't chaired a meeting since I became sober again this year, but this time it's different, and you'll hear that as I share. So as our disease and my disease is cunning, baffling, and insidious, I will try to share with rigorous honesty. That's what the program demands. My experiences. My addiction started years and years ago. I'm age 46, and I didn't learn until this year when I got sober how much the disease was rampant in my family. My extended family, anyway. So I was predestined to swing into action. I guess I really started my life down the road of addiction and alcoholism at the age of, 15 maybe. My parents used to own a nightclub, and they had shelves and shelves of different types of liquor downstairs in our home, and never did I even have a desire. But one night, I guess my first time drinking was, and still really stands out, because it was a snowy night. I live on the east coast of the United States in a town called Baltimore. I live in the county, not in the city, but in Baltimore County. And it was a bit bad snowstorm, and I had a friend over, and we were playing pool, and we decided to hit the bar. Never having a drink before, we polished off, or I should say I polished off, I learned later, that a bottle of rum, and we mixed it with some kind of Coca-Cola or something like that. And those drinks were strong. I had a drink. We each filled a glass, and then we each filled a second, and I find out years later my friend threw out the second one because I guess he was just so loaded, and I was just out of control. And that night, he left and my parents were out, and they came home, and I was curled up in a ball in the bedroom. My father was so angry at me. But before I had gone to bed, I left a present. I got so sick. I left a mural of throw up all on the wall. I was got so sick from that alcohol. I never, ever, ever felt that way before. The next morning, they got home, and they put me to bed, and the next morning, and I never forget, I was shaking so bad from the alcohol. I'm surprised I didn't have alcohol poisoning. I was shaking like I had the DTs. I was literally 15 years old and started out right away. Started out shaking. I often think about that because that was the beginning of nearly 3 decades of using and abusing and chasing and finding ways and means to drink and to use. My story involves a lot of drug use that stemmed initially from alcohol. And my stories with alcohol continued for years and years and years. You know, when I was 18 and 19, I worked in a resort town called Ocean City, Maryland. And I was a teenager, and all we did was we worked, we drank, passed out, and did it again. Worked, drank, and passed out. We always had reasons for drinking. And that was summertime. You know, I worked down there from May until September for 2 years. And I was a kind of teenager that I was dedicated. I worked hard. I helped support the family because the family needed support. But I was also responsible for my own using, so I thought. You know, I always worked and always worked at, and my disease was always working. Let's put it like that. There wasn't much time that I had sober. I mean, I worked hard and I partied hard. But at that point, I was so young, the partying and the drinking and the smoking pot didn't really interfere with my work ethic. And it didn't until years, years, decades later, until this year, you know, where I really hit my bottom. I didn't start hitting a bottom all those years ago. So I was an addict and an alcoholic long before I was the age of 20. And I worked so hard that at age 20 I was working. And this is part of my story, so I'll share it. You know, that I was 19 4 days before I was 20 years old, I was working in a fast food restaurant. And this was the dead of January. And when I finished working down the ocean, I came back and started my job that I had before I went to the ocean, and it was working in a fast food restaurant. And it was January 18th, 1983. And it's funny because when I hear 1983 from some of the people that have been using, that are in these rooms, 1983 is 27 years ago almost. And when I hear that from people who have long time sobriety, it really makes me think how long ago that really was and how many years they have, because in 1983, when I went to work that January 18th, that night, the place got robbed and I got shot by these thugs. These thugs came into the restaurant and they had guns. One jumped the counter. And I got shot in the neck. It paralyzed me from the chest down at age 20. So I had to continue down a road that was mostly or very different from the normal society. You know, I can say years later, thank God I was able to be left the ability to do X, Y, and Z, and that I'm able to get around, I'm able to drive, I'm able to work, I'm able to have my mind. But, and I'm not going to say that getting shot and being paralyzed was a reason to drink and was a reason to get high. I thought that maybe that would be the reason, but you know, I was an addict and an alcoholic even before this incident happened. Being a victim of crime at age 20 isn't easy, and it still isn't easy at age 46. It's a lot better. But the riddle, the cunning, baffling, and insidious disease of alcoholism and addiction was there first. And there are plenty of reasons to use, there's plenty of reasons to drink, there's plenty of reasons for depression, there's plenty of reasons for justifying and rationalizing, and that's what I did. So just because I was injured didn't mean that I would stop using and drinking. And there were I remember when I was in rehab, I was in the rehab hospital with other people that were trying to get better. You know, my injury cut my spine in half with a bullet, and there was no getting better as far as getting physically better, being able to walk again, being able to experience the life I had before I was shot. As far as the physical nature, life changed. So when I say get better, I meant, you know, learn how to live in a wheelchair, learn how to live as a paralyzed person, learn how to live spiritually, well, not spiritually, you know, learn how to live and survive. And I remember while I was in the rehab hospital, couldn't wait to start smoking cigarettes again. Couldn't wait to start smoking pot again, and I remember us going down into the basement or what have you, and you know, getting high that first time after I was hurt. And my disease was waiting. It was lurking in the wings. And it made its presence. And years later, let's see, that was 83, you know, by the mid-90s, you know, I was able, fortunately enough, to get some training and get to work, and I landed a steady job and with the government and the state. And I had a steady job, I had a steady income that just allowed me and my disease to continue down its path at the same time. By the mid-90s, you know, there were weekend rituals filled with alcohol, nightclubs, music. Although I let my disability and my wheelchair prevent me from doing a lot of things in life, it never interfered with my alcoholism. We get buddies and I, we would go out, and it probably started on Friday night, Saturday night, then it turned into Tuesday night. Tuesdays was two for Tuesdays. You could get two drinks for the price of one. Then it became Thursday night. It was ladies' night. We used to pack into these nightclubs like sardines. I'm sitting in a wheelchair and everybody else is standing and we're all drinking. I thought I felt like that made me fit in. Drinking. So it started with Fridays and Saturdays and turned to two for two Tuesdays and ladies night Thursdays, and there was always a reason to drink. Always a reason to drink. And every night, many a night, did I drive home under the influence, rationalizing, justifying it would be okay. And thank the Lord, it was okay. It really wasn't okay, but it was okay that I got home safely every time. So the progression of the disease was setting in. And it got to be a point about the year 2000. I mean, I was the kind of addict that in growing up, even from, you know, it took 10 years, 15, 17 years from the time I got hurt, let's see, 83 to 2000, that I for the disease to set in, you know, I like I said, I come from a family riddled with addiction. You know, my dad was not there very much when I was growing up. You know, he was out fighting his own addiction, fighting his own disease. You know, my brother and I, we smoked pot every day. Every day. We thought it was the thing to do. Our disease was rampant And I say our disease because he was an addict as well. So my alcoholism contributed a lot. My disease was full of alcoholism and drug addiction. And it came to the year 2000 where I had quite enough. You know, going out on the weekends and drinking the way I said I was. And, you know, there were many nights where I'd be drinking so much, you know, I'd fall out of my wheelchair in the middle of the dance floor and people would pick me up and put me back in my chair and I'd have a big smile on my face. Like, wow, this was the life of the party. I had blood coming down from my face, or I had blood all over my white shirt. And when the lights came on at the end of the night, my buddy, who I used to go there with, would say, "What happened to you?" And I'd have this big grin on my face, and I wouldn't even know what happened to me. I wasn't in a blackout, but I was just, you know, maybe, I don't think I was in a blackout, but I drank so much, it tasted good. I can still say that it tasted good, but I know my limits now. We would go on a, I don't want to talk about my drinking, but I realized, you know, we always had reasons to drink, and what we were drinking, we always had reasons to drink what we were drinking. You know, rituals. And I didn't know I really had a problem, you know, all those years, and it did lead into other things. You know, I would go out and drink and start using harder drugs, and I would set myself up to go out to drink, so I would come home and use harder drugs. And it just came to a point, you know, where the life of living in active addiction got to be too much. My life was certainly unmanageable, and I thought I tried to surrender back in the year 2000. I got clean in 2000. I stopped. I became sober. I stopped drinking. I stopped smoking pot. 2000, I started to go to meetings. I started a new way of life. And I remained sober from June of 2000 to July of 2001. Those 13 months were a very good time in my life. That's when I first learned of the disease, that cunning, baffling, and insidious disease that I know so well. And I learned it quite well, even more, that in the year 2001, in July, my younger brother, who was my best friend, he was picked up for vagrancy in Florida, and he was put in jail and, you know, in lockup, and he stayed there for quite some time, and him and I were communicating by mail, letters. And I would write him and I'd let him know how good sobriety was, that I was attending meetings and how good I felt and what I was learning about surrendering and about about just not using and how good life seemed to be. And I really can't say I would write any more about that, because any more about recovery, like more than surrendering and how life was unmanageable and how my life became manageable, because, you know, I thought I came to believe, as the second step says, and I thought I could turn my will and my life over to the care of a higher power. But I realize now, nearly a decade after that, that it wasn't true recovery. But when my brother and I were communicating, he kept writing to me. He wanted what I have. He wanted what I have. And I would write back, well, you could have it. Not sure how he could have it, but, you know, it starts with stop using, stop drinking, don't pick it up. If you don't pick it up, it can't get in you. All the slogans. In July 22nd, 2001, my brother got out of lockup, and I swore that, you know, I talked to my sponsor at the time, and I said, you know, I want to go down there and I want to rescue him. I want to pick him up when he gets out of jail and bring him back here. I can help him get sober. I can help him stay clean. I can help him, thinking that I was in control. And my sponsor and I, we talked about it, and we decided it wasn't good for me and my program at the time. And that was the hardest decision I ever made, because when my brother got out of jail that day, there was nobody waiting there for him, except probably a buddy of his, and they hooked up, and they went and used. My brother died that day with a shot of heroin. He overdosed. And I got a call that day. Thank God I was sober. Thank God I was able to handle that. That was a horrible day. We had just left my mom's. We had a dinner, and I got a call when I got home, and we had to go back to my mom's, and never will forget that day, that we had to tell my mom that her son had just died of a drug overdose. That was horrible, and I swore my disease would never be rampant and active again. I used the death of my brother to try to control. Now, I had been clean up to it, you know, 13 months from that, and all the problems that I've been through in my life, and all the using, and I'm the man of the family. You know, my parents got divorced when I was 18, and my dad went off in his way and in his active using and addiction, and my dad was in jail when my brother got out of jail and died, and it wasn't fun growing up like this, not at all. But I used the death of my brother. You know, I learned of the disease of addiction just a year earlier, and I tried to use this episode to help me stay sober. Thinking I would never use again. I would never pick up a drink again. That I would be sober forever. And I don't know if it wasn't long after that, you know, I hooked up with the wrong person, and And I went out, and it was just for a day. And I came back into the rooms after a day. My disease needed a taste, I guess. But this time, when I came back into the rooms, I wasn't honest. You know, I had a relapse. I picked up, but I never admitted it, and that gave my disease a lot of power. A lot of power. And I kept it in me. And I was able to stay sober for another couple of years until I decided, you know, this was enough. I didn't want to be sober anymore for whatever the reasons was. You know, I went to meetings. I was clean and sober. You know, I thought I was lying to myself. You know, I never admitted I had a relapse, but I was continuing down a path of not admitting, of lying to myself. And that didn't help. So, you know, even in sobriety, life can be unmanageable. And that's when I really realized, you know, when I started using again in the year 2000 and 2003, you know, it took from 2003 until 2009 to realize. You know, I still attended meetings during that time. I started using again. I didn't drink. I didn't smoke pot, but I used my drug of choice. And the funny thing is, it's not funny. The sick thing is that when I stopped drinking and I stopped other drugs in the year 2000, and I became sober for a year and then relapsed a day and then remained sober for 2 years. That episode there, that period of time to my disease, you know, I thought, well, I'm controlling my using. I'm controlling my addiction. I gave up X and Y, but I can continue to use Z. I thought I was in control. I was controlling my addiction. So I thought. During that time from 2003 to 2009, you know, I attended meetings. I was using and I was attending meetings. You know, always thinking I was welcome because of the third tradition. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. But it never felt right, you know. I would go to meetings. I had the desire. There was a constant battle between the desire and the disease. Desire for sobriety and the disease wanting to continue its path. Its horrible, cunning, baffling path. And little did I know how much denial I was really in. You know, I lived for years in denial. and thinking I can control this, I can control my life, I can go to work, I can use on the weekends, I can do this, I can stop drinking, I can stop this and stop that, but still continue to use, I'm in control, I'm in control, I'm in control. My disease was in control. But I thought, oh, if I could sober up, as they say, and I can show up when I need to, then it's okay. And this is how I thought. You know, I had friends in recovery all these years, and they knew when they didn't see me, when they didn't see me at meetings, I always wanted them to come rescue me. But it was me that needed to rescue me, not them needing to rescue me. I always wanted them to come and do a 12th step. Come get me. Come help me. Force me. Nobody ever did. It was only until I had to do that. You know, it got to the point. Even knowing, you know, all these years that my father, over my father's life and my brother's life and my sister's life, my uncle's life, and my great aunts and uncles, where I finally realized after I got sober this year where my disease come from. You know, death in my family has occurred by ages of 23 and 40 and 31 and 37 and 56. You know, premature death from direct result of this disease. Direct result. And I knew this, and I swore to myself I would never use again, and I would never drink again after what happened to my brother. You know, and I thought I can control my drinking, and I didn't do this, and I didn't do that, but I could still use other drugs. My life was so unmanageable. By the time this year rolled around, you know, I really realized just how unmanageable my life really was. Just how sick, just how lonely, just how much pain I was really in. The isolation got to be so bad. You know, I would show up for work. It just got to be so bad that I would show up and not work, show up and be there. I needed that paycheck, you know. So this year, was the year I made my mind up. I decided. I was willing. I finally was willing. Willing for what? Willing to be sober. It's really an amazing thing that, you know, when I was sober years ago, you know, I would surrender. I knew my life was unmanageable, but I never really wanted to close the opportunity down. I always thought, oh, when I'm 70 and I can be sober all these years, I'm going to have a cocktail to celebrate, you know, stuff like that. I always wanted to keep that window just open, just a little bit, to the prospects. That was keeping my disease alive and active. Whether I was using, whether I was sober, whether I was participating in a recovery program, But I realized this year, keeping that window open, that opportunity in my mind open, didn't allow me to recover. I wasn't honest. I wasn't willing up until then. And I realized in April of this year that I had had enough. I had finally had enough. My life was so unmanageable. Not only in with the disease of addiction and alcoholism, because just because I stopped using alcohol years and years ago at the end of this addiction, there was a bottle of vodka in my freezer. And I didn't realize it, but I was going back to places where I had been a decade earlier, and that was kind of scary. Kind of frightening. And at the end of this road, you know, not only was my disease unmanageable, but unmanageability was everywhere in my life. Finances, my social life, my work life. I was isolating, I was lying and manipulating and cheating, and I had no spirit, I had no emotional life. I had bottoms everywhere. Bottoms and bottoms and bottoms. Despite what I knew, you know, I realized I was living in denial for decades. But this time I said, I'm shutting the operation down. I am shutting it down. I am closing that window and locking it. And the only way to do that is to become an active participant in my recovery. Getting honest. Becoming willing. I never forget the first meeting that I went to was a step meeting. And it was on the first step, and they do a step a week. And I get to that meeting not knowing what step they're on, and it was the first step. And that meant something to me. Because I said to myself, you know, I became willing to do what I needed to do to become sober, to live a life of sobriety, to become an active participant in my recovery. And so I did. And I have had that experience, because I've had enough pain of being self-centered, having a self-centered disease, the fear that I experienced, you know, this disease of alcoholism. For me, you know, I was ruled by self-centered fear. You know, living a life the way I've lived, you know, since my injury, it's been difficult, you know, and I used to justify, you know, I could use because of this, and I sometimes didn't have to justify, but life has been different, you know, life on wheels is different than life on legs. And it's not been easy. But I'm not to say that I've not, you know, I've been a productive member of society, whether I've been using or not. You know, I've got a good work ethic, and I've gotten college degrees and all of that, but it meant nothing because my disease was still rampant. And when I became willing, and that's the key, you know, I had to become open, honest, and willing. It's an open, honest, and willing program for me. So I shut the window and I locked it and I got myself into recovery, into back into meetings. And I attended 90 meetings in 90 days in my first 90 days. And I was never willing to do that before. I had all kinds of excuses. I can't do that. I have to do this. I have to do that. I have to get home and blah, blah, blah. I became willing. I became willing. And the funny thing is that as I attended these meetings, there was a therapeutic value of listening to alcoholics and addicts sitting in a room talking about their experiences, strengths, and hopes. And that therapeutic value has helped me a day at a time. I decided that half measures availed me nothing. I couldn't surrender until I realized that. You know, living in a life where I was part-time disease and part-time desire to stop using, desire for sobriety, those were half measures. They availed me nothing. This time, there's no bulking on my steps. I did step one. You know, I knew. I surrendered. I surrendered. My life became unmanageable, and I knew that. And when I attended that second week, and they talked about step two, and then the third week, they talked about step three. And in the 12 and 12 book, in step three, it says, this is the key. You know, turn your will and your life over to the care of a higher power. And all those decades before, you know, a decade before when I got in recovery, I was willing to do the step one. I knew I could surrender. Turns out I never surrendered completely. I knew my life was unmanageable. And I thought I had made a decision, and I thought I had turned my will. But I hadn't been hauled at that. What is God, and what kind of higher power should I have? And I was never really willing. And this time when I heard the reading in the 12 and 12 about turning your life over to the care of God, I said, you know what? I came home that night and I made that third step decision. There was no hemming and hawing about it this time. I had surrendered. This is part of closing that operation down. I have to make that decision. And I have to use my higher power in my life if I'm going to remain sober. And so I did. I made that third step decision. I turned my will and my life over to the care of a higher power. And at the time it was like, well, what am I turning my will and my life over to? I didn't know, but I made that decision. I said, you know what? I'm going to do it. I am not waiting. It's progress, not perfection. So, you know, I did step one, step two, and step three. I've had a sponsor all these years. I'm now willing to live by the principles of recovery, live by the principles of an AA and NA and recovery program. And I need to go to meetings. I have a strong recovery program now. I've learned so much since April. I'm just celebrating my 6-month anniversary, and I thought I would never get to 6 months. I could barely get to 6 hours or 6 days or 6 weeks. Now it's 6 months, and I know it might sound little, but it's a lot to me. It's a daily program. It's a daily reprieve. And for the people that have decades, my hat goes off to you, because that's progress. Certainly not perfection. Because I have friends in these rooms, online, and in face-to-face meetings that have years and years. And they keep coming back. Because somehow the therapeutic value of one alcoholic listening to another alcoholic and one addict listening to another addict is the medicine that I need anyway to allow me to keep that operation shut, to keep that window shut down and locked. So I've learned so much this year. I've learned that I have to be willing, I have to be honest in all of my affairs. I've learned that it's the behavior patterns and my thinking patterns. I need to change how I think. It's not only changing people, places, and things in my life to get rid of the old memories and to live a life in recovery and sobriety that will be positive and not repetitive of the thinking patterns that I've had. You know, it's been hard. It's been hard. But I know what I need to do. You know, coming to believe, becoming willing, becoming honest and sharing about it. These are the kind of thinking patterns to start, you know. I have to remember where I came from. And it's not just with being sober. I have to learn and how to think about my life, my driving, my social interaction with people, my interaction with at the place of business. All of that needs to change, and it has changed, and it will continue to change, because there's not a finite ending to this. There's not a place in my recovery anyway where I can say, okay, at X amount of time, I'm not going to need meetings anymore, because I know what that's like. If I stop going to meetings, my disease will creep back in. That window will become unlocked and a little open again, and maybe open a whole bunch where I might end up where my brother is and where my father is. And that's not going to be good. And I realize that, because there's only certain areas where I can go if my disease became active. And I have to remember this, and I have to know this on an active and daily basis. I have to learn how to share. There's some things that I need to continue. You know, it's progress and not perfection. I need to go to more meetings. I need to share more. I need to reach out more. And it's sometimes difficult, you know, despite my disability, which I don't really let me hold me back that much, you know. I do things despite. And despite, I do things because I have to. You know, I'm willing and I'm open and I'm honest. I've turned my life over to the care of a higher power. I'm working step work with my sponsor. Thank God for sponsors. I have a sponsor that lives within walking distance of where I live, and he moved here not long after I shut the operation down in April, and it's been a godsend. And you know, once I did take that third step and I was willing to do that, I've learned how to turn my will and my life over when I need to. Something goes wrong. I know how to practice what I've learned, and I'm willing to do that, and I need to continue to do that on a daily basis, because I don't want to go back to the loneliness, self-centered pain that I had, the fear that I had. You know, I go to meetings because it helps me, but also because it helps the newcomer. I'm giving back on a daily basis. As much as I need to give it back as well. So, thank God for the recovery programs. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if we could get clean and we can get sober ourselves, there would be no rooms of AA. There would be no reason for 12 steps and 12 traditions. And if Bill W. didn't realize this, that we can't do it ourselves, I tried to failure. Thank God for someone discovering that we need, this is a we program, that we need to do this together, although we do it ourselves on a daily basis. It's funny how we do it ourselves by remaining sober, not picking up that first drink, not picking up that first drug. That's the start of it. And I'm doing that on a daily basis. And I think I always will, because it's a daily program. And I've said this before, you know, my past is gone. I only really have today. But I have to use what I learned yesterday to help me with today so that I can get to tomorrow, if there is a tomorrow, if my higher power sees for it. So I'm about out of words and wisdom, and I'll say the closing prayer later on, and I appreciate having these rooms to go to. I appreciate you allowing me to share my story, my experiences, strengths, and my hopes. You know, I hope I can continue down this pattern of sobriety. It's not a pattern, it's a way of life. I hope I can continue down this way of life at a day at a time for as long as my higher power sees it. Because not many people in my family have realized that they had the disease, and how riddled it was and how riddled it is. Now, I'm a survivor, and I realize that, and I want to survive this disease as well and live and prosper and fulfill the promises that we hear in AA. You know, are these extravagant promises? Well, I think not. And it does take work And there are, have been stumbles in my recovery, you know, but I have the tools now. I have a sponsor. I have the meetings. I have a higher power. And I have the willingness and the openness and the honesty. I have the literature. That I have these tools that I know I need to use in order to remain sober just for today. Thank you, Janice, for allowing me to share. Thank you, Gordy, for taping. Thank you, everyone, for allowing me to share my experiences, strengths, and hopes. And I'm going to turn the meeting back over to you. Y'all have a blessed day.